Voices, we're pleased to have the chance to talk to James Curry about his work in publishing, his connections to African and Caribbean literature, and his memories of Henry Swansea. And then I was going to say, James is a writer, editor, and founder and chairman of Oxford-based James Curry Publishers Limited. He was also a principal figure at Heinemann, where from 1967 to 1984 he oversaw the formative African Writers Series.
Is that and the Caribbean Writers Series.
And the Caribbean Writers Series.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Are those dates okay?
Do you go 67?
67.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
67 to 84.
Is there anything else you'd like me to add into that introduction?
No, I think that's good. Yes. I mean, but the Caribbean obviously is vitally important. Mm-hmm. Separate series.
Yeah.
Longman had drum beats and they put them both. But the big difference, well, you know, perhaps you'll. You go ahead with your questions.
Yes. Okay, well, I'll start with that then. So, as part of the Decolonising Voices project, we're pleased to have the chance to talk to James Curry about his work in publishing, his connections to West African and Caribbean literature, and his memories of Henry Swansea. James is a writer, editor, and the founder and chairman of Oxford-based James Curry Publishers Limited. He was also a principal figure at Heinemann, where from 1967 to 1984, he oversaw the formative African Writers Series and the Caribbean Writers Series. Hello, James, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. Perhaps we might start then by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about your time at the African Writers Series and the Caribbean Writers Series and what you see as critical about those two particular moments.
Well, one of the things that was critical was that the African Writers Series got off to such a splendid start with Chinua Achebe and Googie. And by the time, at that time, I was working for Oxford University Press, running Three Crowns series and various other things to do with which have been started by Rex Collings. And then, amazingly, this job came up in 1967, just when I really was getting frustrated with new management at Oxford University Press. And in fact, when I was interviewed, by Alan Hill, the founding chairman, the person who first thought of, let's have an African writer series, you know, a paperback series for Africa. And actually, at that moment, Keith Sambrook, the overseas director, was actually in the at Mona. It was in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, and discussing with George Lanning the start of the Caribbean Writer Series. So that was absolutely at the start of my Heinemann career. The big difference was African writing, very little published in Britain and America in the 50s. Caribbean writing, quite a lot. You know, Naipaul, Mittelholzer, Michael Anthony, quite a lot was published in hardback, particularly by venturous publishers like André Deutsch. So it meant that the African Writers Series was essentially encouraging new writing, and the Caribbean Writers Series initially didn't do new titles. There was more than enough for us to do a reprint series, which of course was immensely valuable both in schools and universities.
So moving on a little bit then, could you tell us a little bit more about how James Curry Publishing came into being then after?
Right, 1982, Nigerian crisis, the foreign exchanges closed, leaving enormous debts to all the publishers, and so practically everybody, OUP, Longman, Heinemann, Macmillan dropped out of African studies. Right. African studies was coming on brilliantly because there were new universities in Africa. There were new. There was a great deal of interest in the United States, just this moment. But the only Cambridge University Press continued with African studies. So I saw, Claire and I saw a gap in the market. We knew that we could make ends meet as a self-start publisher if we only made sales in the rich world. What we also were interested in was sales in Africa as well, with co-publishing, and indeed with Ian Randall in Jamaica, who was my old Heinemann colleague, and who, in fact, when I got to crisis point in October 1984, I was fortunately, well, that's where I'm standing. The management was in disagreement with me, the new management, who said, you can do two African writer series a year. I went off to Jamaica, and Ian and I used to have discussions every evening about how to start a small publishing house, which of course was immensely valuable to him when he started.
Okay, you mentioned in our discussions earlier that Henry Swansea was a close friend of your family. Perhaps we might focus on him for a few minutes. What was your relationship to him? Could you tell us a little bit about your memories of him as a...
Yes, well, I was born in 1936, so in early 1950s, I was in my teens. One of the nice things at that time was that I was at boarding school in Bath, and we lived in Colchester. And on the way back through London, I don't remember Henry doing this, but it was various other friends of my father's used to get me to record broadcasts on when I was coming back from Oxford, because at Oxford we'd run a course for foreign students, and so this went on to the Africa Service or all the colonial services. It still was. So Henry. Was because he was, as you know, a sort of cheerfully larger than life character, absolutely enchanted teenagers with his naughtiness, and it wasn't so much naughtiness as sort of just sheer crazy individuality. And I remember him, my mother telling me that. Terza saying to him one time when Henry was doing a very vivid imitation of a donkey, and he said, "You can see why he never got into the Foreign Service." We used to hear these stories about these times of. My father used to be amazed going to lunch in, the BBC was in Oxford Street, wasn't it? 101 Oxford Street, crucial address. And Phil Manton, I think, remember his broadcast and these very funny descriptions of Henry actually dancing on the tables or something. I mean, I expect it's sort of slightly exaggerated, but nevertheless. I can well believe it, but I mean he was like this, and was sort of always engaged in. My parents went when they were living in, certainly in London, they decided to hold a rather posh fireworks party for 5th of November and thereabouts, and they were. Firework party were rarer then than they are now, and I think Henry was certainly in a dinner jacket, and he was sitting far to the fireworks in the garden, and I think everything went up to together. The sight of Henry dancing around, with bag, with exploding fireworks, absolutely enchanted all his guests. Wow. He survived it anyhow.
wonder if we can draw these two threads together then for a minute. Could you talk to us perhaps about if there were any connections between Swansea's interest in Ghana at that particular historical moment that he was there in the 1950s and the operations of Hyman in West Africa sort of slightly later? Did you see a network developing there?
Well, Keith Sandbrook was always very admiring of Ghana, as you said. I have my favourite small countries are Czechoslovakia, Scotland, and Ghana. And of course, it had, fortunately, had a crazy governor during the First World War. I mean, he wasn't crazy, he was a civil engineer, but he was considered crazy by the colonial office because he actually invested in Ghana. He put the budget in the red, and so one of the things he invested in, apart from Kolobu Hospital, it was Achimota College, not to mention the docks and everything. So he was at that point, was also a very good Methodist school down at Cape Coast and so on. And these elite schools between wars, Africa, and immediately after, in the period building up to independence, absolutely vital in terms of they had on the whole pretty dedicated teachers, but all these people were actually just being brought up to speed to be able to get the country's independence.
Yeah.
Because after India and after the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya, there was MacLeod and Macmillan were the people who wanted to get rid of the empire as soon as possible, and so the enormous speed of everything was happening, and of course Nkrumah, with the whole philosophy of Pan-Africanism was absolutely. Took us all over. I wish it had worked, because the colonial frontiers are appalling in Africa, but Ghana was absolutely the leading place in sub-Saharan Africa. I think it was Basil Davidson who said that he was a great rival with NASA, and that was why the most powerful broadcasting station at that time was Voice of Cairo, and Nkrumah was very keen on rivaling Voice of Cairo, and so I think he gave it enormous he rated it very high in importance because he really saw it projecting Pan-Africanism, and that could be in culture as well.
And of course the Gold Coast broadcasting system was also bound up in national identity, wasn't
it? Yeah.
One of Henry Swansea's sort of big tasks when he was in Ghana was to be on the editorial panel for the
new national anthem.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Inviting contributions for the lyrics of the new national anthem diaries and in his scrapbooks, his personal scrapbooks, you get all of this detail coming out. So this idea of broadcast culture at the kind of end of empire being very, very important, I think, is something that we're really interested in.
You see, I mean, I was just 21 when they... I was about 18. But this was, of course, the sort of one of the most exciting things. I mean, we hardly noticed Sudan, but Nkrumah and Ghana was, here was this little state compared with this enormous Nigerian state, 3 years ahead of it, and so on. And of course, it really was an exciting period.
I mean, you mentioned a little while ago about that kind of sense of the openness of those times, that everything's possible, and you talked about that kind of the spirit of Pan-Africanism sort of seizing hold of people. I mean, do you get a sense of how Swansea kind of tried to, I guess, on a on a kind of, as a microcosm of that, tried to foster a kind of sense of community amongst writers, or even was involved in, I mean, that's fascinating, the kind of the voice of Cairo versus the West African voices. Those were there tensions there as well between, you know, on a kind of intercontinental or regional scale?
I think he just got on with it.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely my nature, you know, if there's something decent, do it. you know, and I think, I don't know what sense you get, and you'll obviously find this more and more, you know, I think as far as all the sort of ideology is concerned, he just felt that his Garner, after all, the Swansea Trading Co. had, you know, you have your pride and your guilt in your colonial ancestors, and he had a mixture of both, I think. Went into the United Africa Company, went into Unilever, you know, big part of British West African trade. And so, you know, he was fascinated by Gold Coast Ghana. And I don't think he was, he was willing, he was the means to the end. He wanted this country to succeed. He saw it had a very powerful person who had this, so he wanted it as to be disseminated as efficiently as possible.
Yeah. One of the most interesting parts of the diary that we've come across so far is detailing how Swansea used to hold in London these writerly soirees for people who were involved in Caribbean voices, the
Caribbean
writers.
And then, I remember that particularly. That was new to me. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, and there was a sense in these evenings that he was really trying to foster discussions between West African writers and Caribbean writers.
They probably
writers.
Put the fireworks on for them.
Yes, probably did. And so I kind of wonder if there's a sense in which, you know, Swansea is keying into that. From a very different position,
he was wanting to bring the Caribbean writers and the African writers together.
Into dialogue. I mean, the dialogue is mostly social, but I think he's also really interested in what kind of literary and cultural, political connections.
It's terribly important, the social part of growth of writing and so on. I mean, I think it's... I think he was you weren't altogether certain that it had been successful, but the various people who went and taught in West African universities were I'm just going a bit feeble on names. The Leopard by and I think you mentioned a Quincy meeting somebody, was that?
Yes, yeah, I think that's right.
And I would have thought it was very valuable for the for the Africans. I mean,
because you think the Caribbean writing in London was already quite well established.
Yes, I mean, we were all aware of course that the French had done it differently, and that negritude and in particular, and the présence africaine. The Diop's bringing, Césaire became as important in Africa as in the Caribbean, which is, I think, rare among British or English speaking writers. I think those soirees, this whole question of people learning one another's cultures. I mean, my mother was terribly amused by him, Henry bringing George Lamming to lunch, and she was absolutely floored halfway through. She used to put on very good lunches for visiting writers and so on. He turned to my mother and said, "Do you like eating, Mrs. Curry?" And well, that was sort of socially not acceptable to ask an English woman at that time. But you could see. I mean, it was a polite question. But you know, he brought people out to Colchester and so on. I mean, Namming in particular,
yes,
they remember.
Okay, one of the areas that our project is particularly interested in is looking at and trying to kind of unpack the sorts of specific advice that commissioning editors for publishing houses or radio broadcast producers might have offered to writers, and the kind of particular editorial pressures that publishers or broadcast media might have brought to bear on individual authors in the discussion or acceptance of their work. In your experience, how are discussions of kind of literary value conducted, either at Heinemann or James Curry? What sort of debates?
It's very much related to what we were offered, because essentially the writers were a long way ahead of us, and this was, you know, a whole process of education for Keith Sandbrook, myself, I think it was a very good article in the Financial Times quite recently about Maher's, the Libyan writer, and the Gideon Rackman, the who's on the Financial Times, wrote this article sort of talking about the importance of writing in terms of showing you the depth of the culture. I mean, we certainly were just ever open, ever fascinated. Keith probably, in European terms, was a slightly lefter than I was. I was a sort of a liberal middle, really, and he was more left. Alan Hill came from a his father had been a National Union of Teachers, active in the National Union of Teachers, and he liked to think he was left, but he would regularly slip up. But I, on the whole, I just couldn't believe my luck, really, that this stuff was absolutely pouring into the office. I mean, it was just, used to have a, in Bedford Square office, there was a lovely, I had lovely, one of those Duke of Bedford windows, looking over, you could see Jonathan Cape over there, you could see Thames and Hudson over there, you could see, I mean, it was absolutely publishing land. It was very, very, very handsome. The manuscripts used to come and mount. And when they used to be in danger of falling over, I used to grab a pile of them, put them in my rucksack, and rush for the train. And I usually, just to sort out which one wanted to get read or not. A lot of these manuscripts, well, not a lot, some of the manuscripts were pretty crude. I mean, it was the one we did, The Slums by Akari in Nairobi, very revealing about slum life, handwritten on in an exercise book on both sides, you know. And obviously, it's, lots of people are going to have lots of entertaining time criticizing what I did, but anyhow, that's up to them. I enjoyed doing it.
That's really interesting, and there's a connection there between what we're kind of uncovering about how Swansea was working. Receiving an awful lot of material from Cedric and Gladys Lindo in Jamaica.
Yes,
and
tell me about the agents. Was it, how many agents did he have?
The principal agents seemed to be the Lindos, Cedric and
they were kind of collating things from around the island.
Were they Jamaicans?
Yes, they were. And I was talking to Philip Nanton only earlier in the week about this, and he was saying that there's a little bit of critical disagreement. No one's quite sure, because the primary correspondence seems to be between Henry and Gladys, Lindo. And yet, Philip suspects that actually it was Cedric who did most of the kind of dealing, and Gladys was just the correspondent. So there's a kind of...
Did they travel at all, or did it all? Was it all...
I think they were fairly sort of permanently resident in Jamaica.
What, occasionally bought from Spain or something?
It's a regionally based. Yeah. One of the things that Philip was saying was it was quite curious, because I raised this point about Henry Swansea at some point being sort of an editor and perhaps being slightly patrician in response to some things coming in. And Philip was interesting, and he was saying, well, actually... that's true, but also the reverse is often the case, in that Swansea could be quite radical in his choice of literary texts, sort of almost going against the tide of quite conservative, with a small c, Jamaican tastes in stories about religion or social mores.
Yes.
And so there's an interesting kind of...
So he would stir things up a bit,
yeah.
I think obviously the Lindos were taking kind of submissions from across the Caribbean and would filter them... for kind of Swansea and the BBC and filtering them in terms of what they thought would be acceptable to some degree. And often that, certainly, like, for example, Swansea was keener to get that broader sense of what was being done, but there was already a kind of filtering process in place.
I probably told you this time when I was cleaning up my father's house in Colchester, and I saw Caribbean Voices script, and I thought the introduction, I was longing to, that it was my father that said it, but it said something like this, and it was Henry, it was saying, today we're reviewing a book of poetry which has just been published in the Port of Spain, and one can say straight away that it's a work of genius. Walcott.
Oh.
You know, but I mean, he really knew it. I mean, well, there were jolly few and far between these scripts. I mean, I mean, one of the most important scripts we ever, in my first, I think in my first month at Heinemann, Ikwe Amar, the beautiful ones yet not born from Ghana.
Yeah.
Again, absolutely no. You know, this was something absolutely new. In his case, the amazing working of the image of shit, including escaping from the coup through the night soil.
Quite a controversial work politically as well.
I mean, it was the beginning of disillusionment with you know, here we were in the heroic age of everything was going to be sorted out.
I mean,
these
bloody
politicians.
I kind of, because you talk about that again, that, you know, the sense of Pan-Africanism, this moment of hope and so on, which I guess to some degree the publishing would want to reflect that. But I mean, then was there a sense in which that then shifts to kind of looking for those texts that have become more critical as, you know, as there's that kind of sense of disillusionment? I mean, what was the relationship between those kind of changing times and perhaps the decisions that Heinemann and so on were making as to what gets published, or was it just a kind of...
Well, I've just done an article for a Festschrift about African literature today, and which Eldred Jones did, and I was just rereading his sort of 10th anniversary issue, you know, here was the sort of, you know, here was Googie having been detained without trial in Kenya for 11 months, and, you know, all this, you know, sort of, he was sort of saying, well, you know, things have changed. Perhaps what everybody underestimated was the sort of logic in this change, that the British were so and the French were so so keen to have a client class that they bought a border mean, sort of. So I think this was where, this is where writing is so absolutely important. And what's marvellous about a lot of people, particularly Americans, sort of say, oh, you know, it's African Writers' Series, improper that it should be in the metropolitan centre and so on. But that had enormous advantages because we had absolute freedom. If we never published, never sold another book in Ethiopia, it didn't actually matter much to us. We wanted Ethiopian writers who were censored and so on to appear. I remember this crazy man, Marichera, this Zimbabwean writer, sort of he was saying, oh, it's marvellous news, my book's been banned in South Africa. Well, I said, no, all these people that we've met and talked to, they could, you know, it's making it more difficult for them to read. But the thing about an international publisher was that we could actually afford to publish. In fact, of course, I mean, as soon as they were banned, their value was enhanced. And so I mean, that's not much good for either the writer, and especially if the writer's, you know, trying to jail or whatever it is, you know, or Googie, or of course, you know, people on Robben Island and so on. But their voices, I mean, Dennis Bruce's Letters to Martha, written as disguised letters to his sister-in-law, Martha from the island and so on. I know all this was sort of part and parcel. I know Aminata Fauna, a Sierra Leonean writer who I greatly admire, she said the other day, my English writing friends absolutely green with envy because I've got so much to write about. And I think, you know, there is an interpretation of societies that does go on, but I mean, I think in the end the novel has to, or the, well, poetry, but novel in particular, has to work within its own terms.
That's great. I've just really got one more kind of question that I'd like to bring up. That when we were speaking a few months ago, you mentioned that you had attended the Caribbean Artist Movement Conference.
Oh yes, in 67.
And I was thinking about Swansea, who appeared at the CAM conference, I think maybe in 68, and spoke about how he felt, in a sense, the world of Caribbean letters had moved on beyond him. You know, this is after he's been to Ghana and returned. And he was left feeling something like a Swansea zombie, that perhaps his kind of time or his influence or the connections he had with that world were kind of moving on. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences at these events and what that meant at the time?
Here I am, I suppose Henry's age at that or plus or minus, that he probably a bit younger than me at that time, 67. Well, when was he born?
1915, I think.
Yeah.
15. 67. How old was he? He was quite young.
52, 53.
Yeah.
52, 53.
Yeah,
80s,
90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Which was about the time that I left literary publishing in when I was 48. So I can sort of and I at that time I was quite upset by it. Claire and I had decided that for survival, that academic publishing was what we could. Make a living out of. But I was sort of, you know, I remember letters from writers and encountering writers in London, oh, James, we miss you, and all that sort of thing. And I missed it. But I had, in fact, I kept trying to sort of, I started flirting with it at various stages, but it was always Claire and Lynn Orange, how you say, you know, you get overwhelmed by the piles of manuscripts as soon as you open. So, I mean, that's sort of just the crude practical factor of not being realistic. And I think Henry, you know, actually it's quite interesting little date count that, because I remember him being a little down on that occasion.
Mm-hmm.
The person that I first got to know then was Anne Walmsley at Long.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd known her before. Mm. And of course, you know, it was sort of absolute revelation to me about, here we were. What was it? 67. It was 67.
Yeah.
It was September. Summer. Anyhow, I'd only been months in Ireland, and I was sort of finding my feet, and you know, all sorts of people like Kenny Ramchand around and so on, stirring things up. And I can see, it's interesting. I mean, I think, when bloody Birmingham Tar and Rubber took over Heinemann, it was, it was a blow in one hand, but actually, I absolutely was saw a way forward, and Claire was sharper about this than I was, and she was the person. I mean, I walked into the kitchen having at home and said, I don't think I've got a future at Heinemann. And she said, well, I'm glad you said it, because she already understood this. I was resisting that. Whereas Henry at that stage, what did he go on to do? Not much.
No.
In his 50s.
Yeah. I mean, I think the link with Ghana remained, didn't it?
Yeah.
One
or two things there.
The Royal African Society. And
yes, of course, the Royal African Society, African Affairs. I mean, extraordinary. The Royal African Society absolutely central to my own wider activities in terms of African interests, and on the editorial board of African Affairs for many years. There was old Henry, you know, it's absolutely marvellous, you know. I remember my parents talking about it and so on. Did he go on in BBC? He must have done, I suppose, a pension or something.
Yeah, I can't remember when he leaves the BBC.
No, I'm not sure.
Officially, no.
He was on secondment, wasn't he, to Ghana?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely
that's
right and proper,
right,
because
yeah.
It was, I mean, his aim was to train up people to take over, saying.
And he was involved in some more BBC work once he comes back.
Yes, yeah, there's some work in the 60s, but I think it's certainly, in terms of its relation to Caribbean Letters, it's a bit more piecemeal. I don't think there's anything quite as cohesive as Caribbean
Voices. Did Caribbean Voices go on during the 60s?
It goes on a little while under the stewardship of V.S. Naipaul, who takes over after Swansea, and then briefly Mittelholzer as well, but I think really after that it kind of winds down.
And what's your impression of it? I mean, V.S. Naipaul, how did he get on with running it?
Well, we were talking to Naipaul's biographer, Patrick French, last month, weren't we? And asked this question about, you know, what changes in editorial practice or production did Naipaul bring to bring to the program, and Patrick seemed to think that more or less things ran the same for a while, but that Naipaul wasn't perhaps as heavily invested in it as a project as Swansea was.
Well, it's always had a sort of ambiguous, well, it's had an ambiguous relationship with everything, but I mean, particularly with Trinidad and India, but anyhow. You know, the trouble with Naipaul is lack of enthusiasm, you know, whereas Henry was, I think, loaded with enthusiasm, you know. If I brought anything to my job, it was that I was enthusiastic and interested, you know, I really was, you know, it was just absolutely marvellous to have all these sort of new ideas appearing, and this sort of how you're caught up in the changeover from you know, in terms of being a white London based intellectual, I suppose Attell was very, very, she was some, did she used to get Henry to write reports on manuscripts and so on, or? Because they actually shared a flat. There were six of you, Weidenfeld and Attill, and
that's right.
I mean, a curious sort of. Well, splendid. I mean, lucky them, really. But
so it's at the start of her book Stet, isn't it, where she mentions living in this flat and hearing Swansea playing melancholy tunes on the piano.
Yes, I don't know to what extent he that was. Perhaps a thread in his life, in a way it's fortunately not been so much in my life, but I mean, certainly as far as I was concerned, I had this, you ask what you want to, you try to get a job after university and so on. So I applied for various jobs. Actually, one of them was André Deutsch, but there were, Alan Wingate, one of his sub.
That's right.
But my father pointed the bottom line. There was no pay. You know.
That's a neat trick.
Yeah.
And I got offered a job at Halton's, and then the Oxford University Press thing. You know, it just was rather attractive that one was going to go overseas. That was sort of, you know, at a time in life when you felt that was sort of an interesting thing to do.
And at a time historically where, as you say, it was a moment of great promise, a lot of things.
Yes, I mean, it was just in South Africa. I arrived 6 months before Sharpeville.
Mm.
And Sharpeville was absolutely the determining point. The whole. The 50s have been Gandhian and trying to work through a non-violent agenda, the government was having apps would have nothing to do with that, like the Kenyan settlers wouldn't really have much to do with it, but it was they had to be told by Macmillan and McLeod what to do, whereas there was nobody to tell, especially when you have people that, well, no, I won't go on. But they had it was, I was, in a way, I was just perhaps over the cusp in that at my time in life, which was, you know, in my 20s, you know, the excitement with working with African colleagues and so on. This was, you know, obviously Chinua Achebe was, well, not obviously, he was actually utterly charming, reasonable, helpful, enthusiastic. person, the ideal person for it, and you know, there was no tensions whatsoever. He valued what we were doing. He realized that our international distribution was getting new writers round in a way that no single country. I mean, we backed up Nigerian publishing this, but essentially, it was a period when we had this fine chap, Ike Higo, in Nigeria, and he used to educate me pretty severely when I used to spend sort of 3 or 4 weeks with him at a time and so on. Yeah. And he used to sort of, he certainly had a sharp way of telling you off. So, I mean, he was the boss.
Yeah.
And that was entirely, you know, especially, you know, rejoice off to South Africa, you know, but anyhow. And then Henry Chikava, who was younger than me in Kenya, he, one of Googie's students, and he was absolutely deeply into the literature.
Mm.
And we just, for instance, Marichero was talking about, you know, I pleaded with Ike and with Henry to get a quick report because I knew Marichero was absolutely skint and that we needed to give him an advance and so on. And Henry put it out to somebody at the university, and she said, this doesn't give a good picture of emerging Africa or something, you see.
Mm.
So Henry just never even mentioned this. He just gave me a copy of the report. He said, you know, if this is his first work, this person has a future, you know.
Mm.
He was behind it. We were together in what we were aspiring to. He, of course, was absolutely marvellous. This whole thing that happens less, that doesn't really happen in the Caribbean, the whole question of languages. I mean, and he and Googie did a lot about actual publishing, and that's what got Googie into detention, actually writing in Kikuyu rather than English.
Mm-hmm.
Much more dangerous. But
yeah.
I think old Henry. Yeah, I think I really hardly remember him at University of Kent, Canterbury, at CAM.
Mm.
He was some, but I think things did emerge separate, in a different way in the Caribbean from Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
And this enormous freedom we had in the 70s to publish as much of that we could find that was good.
Mm.
A lot of it a bit moderate, but some of it absolutely beyond our dreams. You know. Mm.
Well, thank you very much for
good.
Yeah,
giving such
you.
Generous answers and for talking
yes,
to us today.
Well, as you know, I think Henry was. I was fortunate in that my father was very interested in his South African connections, friend of Roy Campbell and William Plumer and various other people, and Jack Cope in particular. I grew up with the assumption that interesting writing came out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. And with Henry, interesting writing coming out of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's really interesting what you said. There was that pressure to you know, this doesn't give a good picture of Africa, for example, an emerging Africa, and he's kind of overriding that with this, yeah, you know, this is just good writing.
I think unfortunately, the Africanized series, Heinemann got themselves into a mess in 2002, 2003, and they sacked the whole international division, stopped any new publishing in the Africanized series. Fortunately, I met in 2008 when I published my book. I met Alex Moore, who was a Longman person, and he told me how he thought it was absolutely marvellous that Pearson had acquired Heinemann and the African Rise series, and then he found it was in a state of distress. So he's invested in it, and did the first new publishing for 10 years last year, the 50th anniversary, and he's had me in as an advisor on it, and that's quite good fun. We met on in Cambridge on Saturday. We had regular discussions, and he says he's going up with Pearson to his range of to the limits of his competence, really, but he's determined to keep the African Rise series going. Not that it has the same role, which was good, because I think the great thing is that the serious amount of publishing of African writers or people of African extraction in London and New York.
Great. Thank you very much.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's